Holgera laughed helplessly and linked her arm with that of the outrageous little man.
I like him,
Tenedra murmured to Geryon, as they followed along the cobwebby passageway.
You're supposed to, me girl,
Geryon said in a not altogether perfect imitation of the juggler's brogue.
"'Tis a part of his charm, don't you know?
Oh, Geryon,
she laughed.
I love you.
Yes, I know.
She gave him an exasperated look and then punched him in the shoulder with her little fist.
Ouch!
Did I hurt you?
She asked, taking his arm in sudden concern.
I think I can stand it, dear, he replied. We noble heroes can bear all sorts of things.
They followed Feldegast's lantern for a mile or more, with the horses clattering along behind them through the cobweb-draped passageway. Occasionally, they heard the rumble of the dead carts bearing their mournful freight through the streets above. Here, in the musty darkness, however, there was only the sound of the furtive skittering of an occasional errant mouse and the whisper-like tread of watchful spiders moving cautiously across the vaulted ceiling.
I hate this, Silk said to no one in particular. I absolutely hate it.
That's all right, Keldar,
Velvet replied, taking the little man's hand.
I won't let anything hurt you.
Oh, thanks, awfully, he said, though he did not remove his hand from hers.
Who's there?
The voice came from somewhere ahead.
Oh, 'tis only me, good Master Yarblick, Feldegast replied.
Me and a few lost strayed souls trying to find their way on this dark, dark night.
Do you really enjoy him all that much?
Yarblick said sourly to someone else.
He is the delight of my life,
Vela's voice came through the darkness.
At least with him, I don't have to look to my daggers every minute to defend my virtue.
Yarblick sighed gustily.
I had a feeling that you were going to say something like that.
M'lady,
Vela said, making an infinitely graceful curtsy to Pulgra, as the sorceress and the juggler, arm in arm, moved up to the place where a moss-grown rockfall blocked the passageway.
Vela,
Pulgra responded, in an oddly Nadrak accent.
May your knives always be bright and keen.
There was a strange formality in her greeting, and Geryon knew that he was hearing an ancient ritual form of address.
And may you always have the means at hand to defend your person from unwanted attentions.
The Nadrak dancing girl responded automatically, completing the ritual.
What is happening up above?
Belgareth asked the felt-coated Yarblick.
They are dying,
Yarblick answered shortly.
Four streets at a time.
Have you been avoiding the city?
Silk asked his partner. Yarblick nodded.
We are camped outside the gates. We got out just before they chained them shut. Dolmar died, though. When he realized that he had the plague, he got out an old sword and fell on it.
Silk sighed.
Oh. He was a good man. A little dishonest, maybe, but a good man all the same.
Yarblick nodded sadly.
At least he died clean, he said.
Then he shook his head.
The stairs up to the street are over here, he said, pointing off into the darkness. It's late enough so that there's nobody much abroad, except for the dead carts and the few delirious ones stumbling about, looking for a warm gutter to die in.
He squared his shoulders.
Let's go, he said. The quicker we can get through those streets up there, the quicker we can get back underground where it is safe.
Does the passage go all the way to the city wall?
Geryon asked him. Yarblick nodded.
And a mile or so beyond. It comes out in an old stone quarry.
He looked at Feldegast.
You never did tell me how you found out about it. 'Tis one of me secrets, good Master Yarblick,
the juggler replied.
No matter how honest a man might be, it's always good to know a quick way out of town, don't you know?
Oh, that makes sense, Silk said.
You ought to know, Yarblick replied. Let's get out of here.
They led the horses to a flight of stone stairs, reaching up into the darkness beyond the circle of light from Feldegast's lantern. Then, laboriously, hauled the reluctant animals up the stairway one step at a time. The stairway emerged in a rickety shed with a straw-littered floor. After the last horse had been hauled up, Feldegast carefully lowered the long trapdoor again and scuffed enough straw over it to conceal it.
"'Tis a useful sort of thing,"
he said, pointing downward toward the hidden passage.
"'But a secret's no good at all, if just anybody can stumble over it.'
Yarblick stood at the door, peering out into the narrow alleyway outside.
"'Anybody out there?' Silk asked him.
"'A few bodies,' the Nadrek replied laconically. "'For some reason, they always seem to want to die in alleys.'
He drew in a deep breath.
All right, let's go then.
They moved out into the alley, and Geryon kept his eyes averted from the contorted bodies of the plague victims, huddled in corners or sprawled in the gutters. The night air was filled with smoke from the burning city, the reek of burning flesh, and the dreadful smell of decay. Yarblick also sniffed, then grimaced.
From the odor, I would say that the dead carts have missed a few.
He led the way to the mouth of the alley and peered out into the street.
It's clear enough. Just a few looters picking over the dead. Come on.
They went out of the alley and moved along a street illuminated by a burning house. Geryon saw a furtive movement beside the wall of another house, then made out the shape of a raggedly dressed man crouched over a sprawled body. The man was roughly rifling through the plague victim's clothes.
"'Won't he catch it?'
he asked Yarblick, pointing at the looter.
Yeah, "'Probably,'
Yarblick shrugged.
"'I don't think the world's going to miss him very much if he does, though.'
They rounded a corner and entered a street where fully half of the houses were on fire. A dead cart had stopped before one of the burning houses, and two rough-looking men were tossing bodies into the fire, with casual brutality.
"'Stay back!' one of the men shouted to them. "'There's plague here!'
"'There's plague everywhere in this mournful city, don't you know?' Feldegast replied. "'But we thank you for warning us anyway. We'll just go on by on the other side of the street, if you don't mind.'
He looked curiously at the pair.
"'How is it that you're not afraid of the contagion yourselves?'
"'We've already had it.' One replied with a short laugh. I've never been so sick in my life, but at least I didn't die from it, and they say you can only catch it once.
'Tis a fortunate man you are, then, Feldegast congratulated him.
They moved on past the rough pair and on down to the next corner.
We go this way, Feldegast told them.
How much farther is it? Bulgarath asked him.
Not far. And then we'll be back underground, where it's safe.
You might feel safe underground, Silk said sourly, but I certainly don't. Halfway along the street, Geryon saw a sudden movement in one of the deeply inset doorways. Then he heard a feeble wail. He peered at the doorway. Then one street over, a burning house fell in on itself, shooting flame and sparks high into the air. By that fitful light, he was able to see what was in the shadows. The crumpled figure of a woman lay huddled in the doorway, and seated beside the body was a crying child, not much more than a year old. His stomach twisted as he started at the horror before his eyes. Then, with a low cry, Tsenedra darted toward the child with her arms extended.
Tsenedra,
he shouted, trying to shake his hands free of Kretien's reins.
No!
But before he could move in pursuit, Vela was already there. She caught Tsenedra by the shoulder and spun her around roughly.
Tsenedra,
she snapped.
Stay away! Let me go!
Tsenedra almost screamed.
Can't you see that it is a baby?
She struggled to free herself. Very coolly, Vela measured the little queen, then slapped her sharply across the face. So far as Geryon knew, it was the first time anyone had ever hit Tsenedra.
That baby is dead, Tsenedra,
Bella told her with brutal directness.
And if you go near it, you will die too.
She began to drag her captive back toward the others. Zinedra stared back over her shoulder at the sickly, wailing child, her hand outstretched toward it. Then Velvet moved to her side, put an arm about her shoulders, and gently turned her so that she could no longer see the child.
Zinedra, you must think first of your own baby. Would you want to carry this dreadful disease to him?
Zinedra stared at her.
Or do you want to die before you ever see him again?
With a sudden wail, Zinedra fell into Velvet's arms, sobbing bitterly.
I hope she won't hold any grudges,
Vella murmured.
You are very quick, Vella,
Polgora said.
And you think very fast when you have to.
Vella shrugged.
I have found that a smart slap across the mouth is the best cure for hysterics.
Polgora nodded.
It usually works,
she agreed approvingly. They went on down the street until Feldegast led them into another smelly alley. He fumbled with the latch to the wide door of a boarded-up warehouse, then swung it open.
Here we are, then,
he said, and they all followed him inside. A long ramp led down into a cavernous cellar, where Yarblick and the little juggler moved aside a stack of crates to reveal the opening of another passageway. They led their horses into the dark opening, and Feldegast remained outside to hide the passage again. When he was satisfied that the opening was no longer visible, he wormed his way through the loosely stacked crates to rejoin them.
And there we are,
he said, brushing his hands together in a self-congratulatory way.
No man at all can possibly know that we've come this way, don't you know? So let's be off.
Geryon's thoughts were dark as he trudged along the passageway, following Feldegast's winking lantern. He had slipped away from a man for whom he had begun to develop a careful friendship, and had left him behind in a plague-stricken and burning city. There was probably very little that he could have done to aid Zakath, but his desertion of the man did not make him feel very proud. He knew, however, that he had no real choice. Tsaratus had been too adamant in her instructions. Compelled by necessity, he turned his back on Malzeth and resolutely set his face toward Asheba. Part 3. Asheba. Chapter 13. The road leading north from Malzeth passed through a fair, fertile plain where new-sprouted grain covered the damp soil like a low, bright green mist, and the warm spring air was filled with the urgent scent of growth. In many areas, the landscape resembled the verdant plains of Arendia or the tidy fields of Sindaria. There were villages, of course, with white buildings, thatched roofs, and dogs that came out to stand at the roadside and bark. The spring sky was an intense blue dotted with puffy white clouds grazing like sheep in their azure pastures. The road was a dusty brown ribbon. It ran straight where the surrounding green fields were flat, and folded and curved where the land rose in gentle rounded hills. They rode out that morning in glistening sunshine with the sound of the bells fastened about the necks of Yarblick's mules, providing a tinkling accompaniment to the morning song of flights of birds caroling to greet the sun. Behind them there rose a great column of dense black smoke, marking the huge valley where Malzeth lay burning. Geryon could not bring himself to look back as they rode away. There were others on the road as well, for Geryon and his friends were not the only ones fleeing the plague-stricken city. Singly or in small groups, wary travelers moved north, fearfully avoiding any contact with each other, leaving the road and angling far out into the fields whenever they overtook other refugees, and returning to the brown, dusty ribbon only when they were safely past. Each solitary traveler or each group thus rode in cautious isolation, putting as much empty air about itself as possible. The lanes branching off from the road and leading across the bright green fields were all blocked with barricades of fresh-cut brush and bleak-faced peasants stood guard at those barricades, awkwardly handling staffs and heavy, graceless crossbows, shouting warnings at any and all who passed to stay away.
"Peasants,"
Yarblick said sourly, as the caravan plodded past one such barricade.
"They are the same the world over. They're glad to see you when you've got something they want. But they spend all of the rest of their time trying to chase you away. Do you think they actually believe that anybody would really want to go into their stinking little villages?"
Irritably, he crammed his fur cap down lower over his ears.
"They are afraid," Balra told him. "They know that their village is not very luxurious, but it is all that they have, and they want to keep it safe."
"Do those barricades and threats really do any good? To keep out the plague, I mean."
Some, if they put them up early enough."
Yarblick grunted, then looked over at Silk.
"Are you open to a suggestion?"
"It depends," Silk replied. The little man had returned to his customary travel clothing, dark, unadorned, and nondescript.
"Between the plagues and the demons, the climate here is starting to turn unpleasant. What say we liquidate all of our holdings here in Meloria and sit tight until things settle down?"
"You're not thinking, Yarblick. Turmoil and war are very good for business."
Yarblick scowled at him.
"Somehow I thought you might look at it that way."
About a half a mile ahead, there was another barricade. This one, across the main road itself.
"What is this?"
Yarblick demanded angrily, reining in.
"I'll go find out," Silk said, thumping his heels against his horse's flanks.
On an impulse, Geryon followed his friend. When they were about 50 yards from the barricade, a dozen mud-spattered peasants, dressed in smocks made of brown sackcloth, rose from behind it with leveled crossbows.
"Stop right there,"
one of them commanded threateningly. He was a burly fellow with a coarse beard and eyes that looked off in different directions.
"We're just passing through, friend," Silk told him.
"Not without paying a toll, you are not."
"Toll?" Silk exclaimed. "This is an imperial highway. There's no toll."
"There is no. You city people have cheated and swindled us for generations, and now you want to bring your diseases to us. Well, no, from now on, you are going to pay. How much gold have you got?"
"Keep him talking,"
Geryon muttered, looking around.
"Well,"
Silk said, to the wall-eyed peasant, in the tone of voice he usually saved for serious negotiations,
"why don't we talk about that?"
The village stood about a quarter of a mile away, rising dirty and cluttered-looking atop a grassy knoll. Geryon concentrated, drawing in his will. Then he made a slight gesture in the direction of the village.
"Smoke,"
he muttered, half under his breath. Silk was still haggling with the armed peasants, taking up as much time as he could.
"Excuse me?"
Geryon interrupted mildly. "But is that something burning over there?" He pointed. The peasants turned to stare in horror at the column of dense smoke rising from their village. With startled cries, most of them threw down their crossbows and ran out across the fields in the direction of the apparent catastrophe. The wall-eyed man ran after them, shouting at them to return to their posts. Then he ran back, waving his crossbow threateningly. A look of anguish crossed his face as he hopped about in an agony of indecision, torn between his desire for money, that could be extorted from these travelers, and the horrid vision of a fire raging unchecked through his house and outbuildings. Finally, no longer able to stand it, he also threw down his weapon and ran after his neighbors.
"Did you really set their village on fire?"
Silk sounded a little shocked.
"Of course not," Geryon said. "Then where is the smoke coming from?"
"Lots of places," Geryon winked. "Out of the thatch on their roofs, up from between the stones in the streets, boiling up out of their cellars and granaries, lots of places. But it is only smoke." He swung down from Christian's back and gathered up the discarded crossbows. He lined them up, nose down, in a neat row along the brushy barricade.
"How long does it take to restring a crossbow?"
he asked. "Hours," Silk suddenly grinned.
"Two men to bend the limbs with a windlass, and another two to hook the cable into place."
"Mm-hmm, that's what I thought,"
Garion agreed. He drew his old belt knife and went down the line of weapons, cutting each twisted rope cable. Each bow responded with a heavy twang.
"Shall we go, then?"
"What about this?"
Silk pointed at the brushy barricade. Garion shrugged.
"Oh, I think we can ride around it."
"What were they trying to do?"
Durnick asked when they returned.
"An enterprising group of local peasants decided that the highway needed a toll gate about there," Silk shrugged. "They didn't really have the temperament for business affairs, though. At the first little distraction, they ran off and left the shop untended."
They rode on past the now deserted barricade, with Yarblek's laden mules plodding along behind them, their bells clanging mournfully.
"I think we are going to have to leave you soon," Belgareth said to the fur-capped Nadrak. "We have to get to Asheba within the week, and your mules are holding us back."
Yarblek nodded.
"Nobody ever accused a pack mule of being fast on his feet," he agreed. "I'll be turning toward the west before long anyway. You can go into Coranda if you want to, but I want to get to the coast as quickly as possible."
"Garion," Bulgara said. She looked meaningfully at the column of smoke rising from the village behind them.
"Oh, I guess I forgot."
He raised his hand, trying to make it look impressive. "Enough," he said, releasing his will. The smoke thinned at its base, and the column continued to rise as a cloud cut off from its source.
"Don't over-dramatize, dear," Polgara advised. "It's ostentatious." "But you do it all the time," he accused.
"Yes, dear, but I know how."
It was perhaps noon when they rode up a long hill, crested it in bright sunshine, and found themselves suddenly surrounded by mailed red-tunicked Malorian soldiers who rose up out of ditches and shallow gullies with evil-looking javelins in their hands.
"You, halt!"
the officer in charge of the detachment of soldiers commanded brusquely. He was a short man, even shorter than Silk, though he strutted about as if he were 10 feet tall.
"Of course, Captain,"
Yarblek replied, reining in his horse.
"What do we do?"
Garion hissed to Silk.
"Let Yarblek handle it,"
Silk murmured.
"He knows what he's doing."
"Where are you bound?"
the officer asked when the rangy Nadrak had dismounted.
"Maldaria,"
Yarblek answered.
"Or Melkamat, wherever I can hire ships to get my goods to Yar Marak."
The captain grunted as if trying to find something wrong with that.
"What's more to the point is where you've come from."
His eyes were narrowed.
"Magaren,"
Yarblek shrugged.
"Not Malzeth?"
The little captain's eyes grew even harder and even more suspicious.
"I don't do business in Malzeth very often, Captain. It costs too much, all those bribes and fees and permits, you know." "I assume that you can prove what you say?"
The captain's tone was belligerent.
"I suppose I could, if there's a need for it." "There is a need, Nadrak. Because unless you can prove that you have not come from Malzeth, I am going to turn you back."
He sounded smug about it.
"Turn back? That's impossible. I have to be in Boktor by midsummer." "That is your problem, merchant."
The little soldier seemed rather pleased at having upset the larger man.
"There is a plague in Malzeth, and I am here to make sure that it does not spread."
He tapped himself importantly on the chest.
"Plague?"
Yarblek's eyes went wide, and his face actually paled.
"Torak's teeth!
and I almost stopped there.
He suddenly snapped his fingers.
So that's why all the villages hereabouts are barricaded. Can you prove that you came from Magarin?
The captain insisted.
Well,
Yarbluck unbuckled a well-worn saddlebag, hanging under his right stirrup, and began to rummage around in it.
I've got a permit here issued by the Bureau of Commerce,
he said rather dubiously.
It authorizes me to move my goods from Magarin to Maldaria, if I can't find ships there. I'll have to get another permit to go on to Malkamat, I guess. Would that satisfy you? Let's see it.
The captain held out his hand, snapping his fingers impatiently. Yarbluck handed it over.
It is a little smeared,
the captain accused suspiciously.
I spilled some beer on it in a tavern in Pindaka,
Yarbluck shrugged.
Weak, watery stuff it was. Take my advice, captain. Don't ever plan to do any serious drinking in Pindaka. It's a waste of time and money. Is drinking all you Nadraks ever think about? It's the climate. There's nothing else to do in Garag Nadrak in the wintertime. Have you got anything else?
Yarbluck pawed through his saddlebag some more.
Here's a bill of sale from a carpet merchant on Yorba Street in Magarin. Pockmarked fellow with bad teeth. Do you by any chance know him? Why would I know a carpet merchant in Magarin? I am an officer in the Imperial Army. I do not associate with riffraff. Is the date on this accurate? How should I know? We use a different calendar in Garag Nadrak. It was about 2 weeks ago, if that's any help.
The captain thought it over, obviously trying very hard to find some excuse to exert his authority. Finally, his expression became faintly disappointed.
All right,
he said grudgingly, handing back the documents.
Be on your way, but do not make any side trips, and make sure that none of your people leave your caravan. They'd better not leave, not if they want to get paid. Thank you, captain.
Yarbluck swung back up onto his saddle. The officer grunted and waved them on.
Little people should never be given any kind of authority,
the Nadrak said sourly when they were out of earshot.
It lies too heavily on their brains.
Yarbluck, Silk objected.
Oh, present company accepted, of course.
Oh, well, that's different then.
Ye lie like ye were born to it, good Master Yarbluck,
Feldegast the juggler said admiringly.
I have been associating with a certain Drasnian for too long.
How did you come by the permit and the bill of sale?
Silk asked him. Yarbluck winked and tapped his forehead slyly.
Official types are always overwhelmed by official-looking documents. And the more petty the official, the more he is impressed. I could have proved to that obnoxious little captain back there that we came from any place at all. Mersin, Aduma in the mountains of Zamad, even Krol Tibo on the coast of Gandahar. Except that all you can buy in Krol Tibo are elephants, and I don't have any of those with me, so that might have made him even a little more suspicious.
Silk looked around with a broad grin.
Now you see why I went into partnership with him,
he said to them all.
You seem well suited to each other,
Velvet agreed. Belgarath was tugging at one ear.
I think we will leave you after dark tonight, he said to Yarbluck. I don't want some other officious soldier to stop us and count noses, or decide that we need a military escort.
Yarbluck nodded.
Are you going to need anything?
Just some food is all.
Belgarath glanced back at their laden pack horses, plodding along beside the mules.
We have been on the road for quite some time now, and we have managed to gather up what we really need and discard what we do not.
I'll see to it that you have got enough food,
Vela promised,
from where she was riding between Tenedra and Velvet.
Yarblack sometimes forgets that full ale cakes are not the only things you need on a journey. And will ye be riding north, then?
Feldegast asked Belgoroth. The little comic had changed out of his bright-colored clothes and was now dressed in plain brown.
Unless they have moved it, that's where Ashaba is, Belgoroth replied.
If it be all the same to ye, I'll ride along with ye for a bit of a ways.
Oh?
There was a little difficulty with the authorities the last time I was in Maldaria, and I'd like to give 'em time to regain their composure before I go back for me triumphant return engagement. Authorities tend to be a stodgy and unforgiving lot, don't you know? Always dredging up old pranks and bits of mischief, perpetrated in the spirit of fun, and throwing 'em in your face.
Belgoroth gave him a long, steady look, then shrugged.
Why not? He said.
Geryon looked sharply at the old man. His sudden acquiescence seemed wildly out of character, given his angry protests at the addition of Velvet and Tzadi to their party. Geryon then looked over at Polgara, but she showed no signs of concern either. A peculiar suspicion began to creep over him. As evening settled over the plains of Meloria, they drew off the road to set up their night's encampment in a park-like grove of beech trees. Yarblek's muleteers set about one campfire, passing an earthenware jug around and becoming increasingly rowdy. At the upper end of the grove, Geryon and his friends sat around another fire, eating supper and talking quietly with Yarblek and Vela.
"Be careful when ye crossed into Vena,"
Yarblek cautioned his rat-faced partner.
"Some of the stories coming out of there are more ominous than the ones coming out of Karanda."
"Oh?
It's as if a kind of madness has seized them all. Of course, Grolems were never very sane to begin with."
"Grolems?"
Tzadi looked up sharply.
"Ven is a church-controlled state," Sulk explained. "All authority there derives from Irvan and his court at Malyaska."
"It used to," Yarblek corrected. "Nobody seems to know who's got the authority now. The Grolems gather in groves to talk. The talk keeps getting louder until they're screaming at each other. Then they all reach for their knives. I haven't been able to get the straight of it. Even the temple guardsmen are taking sides."
"The idea of Grolems cutting each other to pieces is one that I can live with," Sulk said.
"Truly," Yarblek agreed. "Just try not to get caught in the middle."
Feldegast had been softly strumming his lute, and he struck a note so sour that even Geryon noticed it.
"Well, that string's out of tune,"
Durnik advised him.
"Aye, I know,"
the juggler replied.
"The peg keeps slipping."
"Well, let me see it," Durnik offered. "Maybe I can fix it."
"'Tis too worn, I fear, friend Durnik. 'Tis a grand instrument, but it's old."
"Well, those are the ones that are worth saving."
Durnik took the lute, twisted the loose peg, tentatively testing the pitch of the string with his thumb. Then he took his knife and cut several small slivers of wood. He carefully inserted them around the peg, tapping them into place with the hilt of his knife. Then he twisted the peg, retuning the string.
"That should do it," he said.
He took up the lute and strummed it a few times. Then, to a slow measure, he picked out an ancient air, the single notes quivering resonantly. He played the air through once, his fingers seeming to grow more confident as he went along. Then he returned to the beginning again, but this time, to Geryon's amazement, he accompanied the simple melody with a rippling counterpoint so complex that it seemed impossible that it could come from a single instrument.
"That's a nice tune," he observed to Feldegast.
"'Tis a marvel that ye are, Master Smith. First ye repair me lute, and then ye turn around and put me to shame by playing it, far better than I could ever hope to."
Polgara's eyes were wide and luminous.
"Why haven't you told me about this, Durnik?" she asked.
actually. It's been so long that I almost forgot about it.
He smiled, his fingers still dancing on the strings, bringing forth that rich-toned cascade of sound.
When I was young, I worked for a time with a lute maker. He was old, and his fingers were stiff. But he needed to hear the tone of the instruments he made, so he taught me how to play them for him.
He looked across the fire at his giant friend, and something seemed to pass between them. Toth nodded, reached inside the rough blanket he wore across one shoulder, and produced a curious-looking set of pipes, a series of hollow reeds, each longer than the one preceding it, all bound tightly together. Quietly, the mute lifted the pipes to his lips as Durnick returned again to the beginning of the air. The sound he produced from his simple pipes had an aching poignancy about it that pierced Geryon to the heart, soaring through the intricate complexity of the lute song.
"I'm beginning to feel altogether unnecessary," Feldegast said in wonder. "Me own playing of lute or pipe be good enough for taverns and the like. But I be no virtuoso like these two."
He looked at the huge Toth.
"How is it possible for a man so big to produce so delicate a sound?"
"He's very good," Eriond told him. "He plays for Durnick and me sometimes, when the fish aren't biting."
"Ah, 'tis a grand sound," Feldegast said, "and far too good to be wasted."
He looked across the fire at Vella.
"Would you be willing to give us a bit of a dance, me girl, to sort of round out the evening?"
"Why not?"
She laughed with a toss of her head. She rose to her feet and moved to the opposite side of the fire.
"Follow this beat,"
she instructed, raising her rounded arms above her head and snapping her fingers to set the tempo. Feldegast picked up the beat, clapping his hands rhythmically. Geryon had seen Vella dance before, long ago in a forest tavern in Garognadrak, so he knew more or less what to expect. He was sure, however, that Eriond certainly, and Zenedra probably, should not watch a performance of such blatant sensuality. Vella's dance began innocuously enough, and he began to think that perhaps he had been unduly sensitive the last time he had watched her. When the sharp staccato of her snapping fingers and Feldegast's clapping increased the tempo, however, and she began to dance with greater abandon, he realized that his first assessment had been correct. Eriond should not really be watching this dance, and Tenedra should be sent away almost immediately. For the life of him, however, he could not think of any way to do it. When the tempo slowed again, and Durnick and Toth returned to a simple restatement of the original air, the Nadrak girl concluded her dance with that proud, aggressive strut that challenged every man about the fire. To Geryon's absolute astonishment, Eriond warmly applauded with no trace of embarrassment showing on his young face. He knew that his own neck was burning and that his breath was coming faster. Tinedra's reaction was about what he had expected. Her cheeks were flaming and her eyes were wide. Then she suddenly laughed with delight.
"Wonderful!"
she exclaimed, and her eyes were full of mischief as she cast a sidelong glance at Geryon. He coughed nervously. Feldegast wiped a tear from his eye and blew his nose gustily, and then he rose to his feet.
"Ah, me fine lusty wench,"
he said fulsomely to Vella, hanging a regretful embrace about her neck and, endangering life and limb, just a little in view of her ever-ready daggers, bussing her noisily on the lips.
"It's destroyed me altogether, I am, that we must part. And I'll miss ye, me girl, and make no mistake about that. But I make ye me promise that we'll meet again, and I'll delight ye with a few of me naughty little stories, and ye'll fuddle me brains with your wicked brew, and we'll laugh and sing together, and enjoy spring after spring, in a sheer delight of each other's company."
And then he slapped her rather familiarly on the bottom, and moved quickly out of range before she could find the hilt of one of her daggers.
"Does she dance for you often, Yarblick?" Silk asked his partner, his eyes very bright.
"Too often," Yarblick replied mournfully. "And every time she does, I find myself starting to think that her daggers aren't really all that sharp, and that a little cut or two wouldn't really hurt too much.
Feel free to try at any time, Yarblek,
Vella offered, her hand suggestively on the hilt of one of her daggers. Then she looked at Zinedra with a broad wink.
Why do you dance like that?
Zinedra asked, still blushing slightly.
You know what it does to every man who watches you. Oh, but that's part of the fun, Zinedra. First you drive them crazy, then you hold them off with your daggers. It makes them absolutely wild. Next time we meet, I'll show you how it's done.
She looked at Garion and laughed a wicked little laugh. Ulgareth returned to the fire. He had left at some time during Vela's dance, though Garion's eyes had been too busy to notice.
It is dark enough, he told them all. I think we can leave now without attracting any notice.
They all rose from where they had been sitting.
You know what to do? Silk asked his partner.
Yarblick nodded.
All right. Do whatever you have to keep me out of the soup.
Why do you persist in playing around in politics, Silk?
Because it gives me access to greater opportunities to steal.
Oh, Yarblick said. That's all right, then.
He extended his hand.
Take care, Silk.
You too, Yarblick. Try to keep us solvent if you can, and I'll see you in a year or so.
If you live.
Oh, there's that, too. I enjoyed your dance, Vella, Polgora said, embracing the Nadrak girl.
I am honored, lady,
Vella replied a bit shyly.
And we will meet again, I'm sure.
I am certain that we will.
Are ye sure that you won't reconsider your outrageous asking price, Master Yarblick?
Feldegast asked.
Talk to her about it,
Yarblick replied, jerking his head in Vela's direction.
She's the one who said it. It is a hard-hearted woman ye are, me girl,
the juggler accused her. She shrugged.
If you buy something cheap, you don't value it.
Oh, no, that's the truth, surely. I'll see what I can do to put me hands on some money, for make no mistake me fine, wench. I mean to own ye.
We'll see,
she replied with a slight smile. They went out of the circle of firelight to their picketed horses and the juggler's mule, and mounted quietly. The moon had set, and the stars lay like bright jewels across the warm velvet throat of night as they rode out of Yarblick's camp and moved at a cautious walk toward the north. When the sun rose several hours later, they were miles away, moving northward along a well-maintained highway toward Malrakuth, the Angorak city lying on the south bank of the Raku River, the stream that marked the southern border of Vena. The morning was warm, the sky was clear, and they made good time. Once again there were refugees on the road, but unlike yesterday, significant numbers of them were fleeing toward the south.
"Is it possible that the plague has broken out in the north as well?" Sadi asked.
Polgara frowned.
It's possible, I suppose.
I think it is more likely that these people are fleeing from Minga,
Belgarath disagreed.
It's going to get a bit chaotic hereabouts, Silk noted. If you've got people fleeing in one direction from the plague, and people fleeing in the other from the demons, about all they'll be able to do is mill around out here on these plains.
That could work to our advantage, Keldar,
Velvet pointed out.
Sooner or later, Zakath is going to discover that we left Malzeth without saying goodbye, and he is likely to send troops out looking for us. A bit of chaos in this region should help to confuse their search, wouldn't you say?
Oh, you've got a point there, he admitted.
Garion rode on in a half-doze, a trick he had learned from Belgarath. Though he had occasionally missed a night's sleep in the past, he had never really gotten used to it. He rode along with his head down, only faintly aware of what was happening around him. He heard a persistent sound that seemed to nag at the edge of his consciousness. He frowned, his eyes still closed, trying to identify the sound. Then he remembered. It was a faint, despairing wail, and the full horror of the sight of the dying child in the shabby street in Malzeth struck him. Try though he might, he could not wrench himself back into wakefulness, and the continuing cry tore at his heart. Then he felt a large hand on his shoulder, shaking him gently. Struggling, he raised his head to look full into the sad face of the giant Toth.
"Did you hear it too?"
Toth nodded, his face filled with sympathy.
"It was only a dream, wasn't it?"
Toth spread his hands, and his look was uncertain. Geryon squared his shoulders and sat up in his saddle, determined not to drift off again. They rode some distance away from the road and took a cold lunch of bread, cheese, and smoked sausage in the shade of a large elm tree standing quite alone in the middle of a field of oats. There was a small spring surrounded by a mossy rock wall not far away where they were able to water the horses and fill their water bags. Belgorath stood looking out over the fields toward a distant village and the barricaded lane which approached it.
"How much food do we have with us, Paul?" he asked. "If every village we come to is closed up the way the ones we've passed so far have been, it's going to be difficult to replenish our supplies."
"I think we'll be all right, Father," she replied. "Vela was very generous."
"I like her," Zinedra smiled, "even though she does swear all the time."
Polgora returned the smile. "It is the Nadrak way, dear. When I was in Garog Nadrak, I had to draw on my memories of the more colorful parts of my father's vocabulary to get by."
"Hello!"
someone hailed them. "He's over there," Silk pointed toward the road. A man was wearing one of the brown robes that identified him as a Malcine bureaucrat, and he sat looking at them longingly from the back of a bay horse.
"What do you want?"
Durnick called to him.
"Can you spare a bit of food?"
the Malcine shouted.
"I can't get near any of these villages, and I haven't eaten in 3 days. I can pay."
Durnick looked questioningly at Polgora. She nodded. "We have enough," she said.
"Which way was he coming?"
Belgorath asked. "South, I think," Silk replied. "Tell him that it's all right, Durnick," the old man said.
"He can probably give us some recent news from the north."
"Come on in,"
Durnick shouted to the hungry man. The bureaucrat rode up until he was about 20 yards away, then stopped warily.
"Are you from Malzeth?" he demanded.
"We left before the plague broke out," Silk lied. The official hesitated.
"I'll put the money on this rock here," he offered, pointing at a white boulder. "Then I will move back a ways. You can take the money and leave some food. That way neither one of us will endanger the other."
"That makes sense," Silk replied pleasantly. Polgora took a loaf of brown bread and a generous slab of cheese from her stores and gave them to the sharp-faced Drasnian. The Malcine dismounted, laid a few coins on the rock, then led his horse back some distance.
"Where have you come from, friend?" Silk asked as he approached the rock.
"I was in Akkad, in Katakor," the hungry man answered, eyeing the loaf and the cheese. "I was senior administrator there for the Bureau of Public Works. You know, walls, aqueducts, streets, that sort of thing. The bribes weren't spectacular, but I managed to get by. Anyway, I got out just a few hours before Minga and his demons got there."
Silk laid the food on the rock and picked up the money. Then he backed away. "We heard that Akkad fell quite some time ago." The Malcine almost ran to the rock and snatched up the bread and cheese. He took a large bite of cheese and tore a chunk off of the loaf.
"I hid in the mountains," he replied around the mouthful.
"Isn't that where Ashaba is?" Silk asked, sounding very casual.
The Malcine swallowed hard and nodded,
That's why I finally left, he said, stuffing bread into his mouth. The area is infested with huge wild dogs, ugly brutes as big as horses. And there are roving bands of Karans killing everyone they come across. I could have avoided all of that, but there's something terrible going on at Ashaba. There are dreadful sounds coming from the castle, and strange lights in the sky over it at night. I don't hold with the supernatural, my friend. So I bolted.
He sighed happily, tearing off another chunk of bread.
A month ago, I'd have turned my nose up at brown bread and cheese. Now, it tastes like a banquet.
Oh, hunger's the best sauce, Silk quoted the old adage.
That's the honest truth.
Why didn't you stay up in Vena?
Didn't you know that there's a plague in Melzeth?
The Melusine shuddered.
What's going on in Vena is even worse than what is going on at Katakor, or Melzeth. Oh, my nerves are absolutely destroyed by all of this. I am an engineer. What do I know about demons and new gods and magic? Give me paving stones and timbers and mortar, and a few modest bribes, and don't even mention any of that other nonsense to me.
New gods? Silk asked. Who has been talking about new gods?
The Kandam. You have heard of them?
Don't they belong to Irvan, the disciple?
I don't think they belong to anybody right now. They've gone on a rampage in Vina. Nobody has seen Irvan for more than a month now. Not even the people in Malieska. The Kandam are completely out of control. They are erecting altars out in the fields and holding double sacrifices, the first heart to Torak, and the second to this new god of Angarak. And anybody up there that does not bow to both altars gets his heart cut out right on the spot.
Oh, that seems like a very good reason to stay out of Vena, Silk said wryly. Have they put a name to this new god of theirs?
Not that I ever heard. They just call him the new god of Angarak, come to replace Torak and to take dreadful vengeance on the godslayer.
That's you. Velvet murmured to Garion. Do you mind? I just thought you ought to know, that's all.
There is an open war going on in Vena, my friend, the Melusine continued, and I would advise you to give the place a wide berth.
War?
Within the church itself. The Kandam are slaughtering all of the old Grolems, the ones who are still faithful to Torak. The temple guardsmen are taking sides, and they are having pitched battles on the plains up there. That's when they're not marauding through the countryside, burning farmsteads and massacring whole villages. You would think that the whole of Vena has gone crazy. It's just as much as a man's life is worth to go through there just now. They stop you. They ask you which god you worship. A wrong answer is fatal.
He paused, still eating.
Have you heard about any place that's quiet and safe?
He asked plaintively. Try the coast, Silk suggested. Mal-Abad, maybe. Or Malkamat.
Which way are you going?
We're going north to the river, and see if we can find a boat to take us down to Lake Pendaka.
It won't be safe there for very long, friend. If the plague doesn't get there first, Menga's demons will. Or the crazed Grolems and their guardsmen out of Vena.
Oh, we don't plan to stop, Silk told him. We are going to cut on across Dershin to Magaren, and then on down to the Magan.
Well, that's a long journey.
Friend, I'll go to Gandahar if necessary, to get away from demons and plague and mad Grolems. If worse comes to worst, we'll hide out among the elephant herders. Elephants aren't all that bad. The Melusine smiled briefly.
Thanks for the food, he said,
tucking his loaf and his cheese inside his robe and looking around for his grazing horse.
Good luck when you get to Gandahar.
And the same to you on the coast, Silk replied. They watched the Melusine ride off.
Why did you take his money, Keldar?
Ariand asked curiously.
I thought we were just going to give him the food.
Unexpected and unexplained acts of charity linger in people's minds, Ariand. And curiosity overcomes gratitude. I took his money to make sure that by tomorrow he won't be able to describe us to any curious soldiers.
Oh, the boy said a bit sadly. It's too bad that things are like that, isn't it?
As Sadi says, I didn't make the world. I only try to live in it.
Well, what do you think? Belgarath said to the juggler.
Feldegast squinted off toward the horizon.
You're dead set on going right straight up through the middle of Vena, past Malyaska and all?
We don't have any choice. We have got just so much time to get to Ashaba.
Somehow, I thought you might feel that way about it.
Do you know a way to get us through?
Feldegast scratched at his head.
"'Twill be dangerous, ancient one,' he said dubiously. "'What with Grolems and Candom, and Temple Guardsmen and all?'
"'It won't be nearly as dangerous as missing our appointment at Ashaba would be.'
"'Well, if you're dead set on it, I suppose I can get you through.'
"'All right,' Belgarath said. "'Let's get started, then.'
The peculiar suspicion which had come over Geryon the day before was growing stronger. Why would his grandfather ask these questions of a man they scarcely knew? The more he thought about it, the more he became convinced that there was a great deal more going on here than met the eye. Chapter 14 It was late afternoon when they reached Malrakuth. A grim fortress city crouched on the banks of a muddy river. The walls were high, and the black towers rose within the walls. A large crowd of people was gathered outside, imploring the citizens to let them enter, but the city gates were locked, and archers with half-drawn bows lined the battlements, threatening the refugees below.
"Well, that sort of answers that question, doesn't it?"
Geryon said as he and his companions reined in on a hilltop some distance from the frightened city. Belgarath grunted.
"It's more or less what I expected. There's nothing we really need in Malrakuth, anyway. So there is not much point in pressing the issue."
"How are we going to get across the river, though?"
"If I remember correctly, there'll be a ferry crossing but a few miles upstream," Feldegast told him.
"Won't the ferryman be just as frightened of the plague as the people in that city are?"
Durnick asked.
"'Tis an ox-drawn ferry, goodman, with teams on each side and cables and pulleys and all. The ferryman can take our money and put us out on the far bank and never come within 50 yards of us. I fear the crossing will be dreadful expensive, though."
The ferry proved to be a leaky old barge attached to a heavy cable stretched across the yellow-brown river.
"Stay back!"
The mud-covered man holding the rope hitched about the neck of the lead ox on the near side commanded as they approached.
"I don't want any of your filthy diseases."
"How much to go across?"
Silk called to him. The muddy fellow squinted greedily at them, assessing their clothing and horses.
"One gold piece," he said.
"Oh, that's outrageous.
Try swimming."
"Pay him?"
Belgarath said. "Oh, not likely," Silk replied. "I refuse to be cheated even here. Let me think a minute." His narrow face became intent as he stared hard at the rapacious ferryman. "Durnick," he said thoughtfully, "do you have your axe handy?" The smith nodded, patting the axe which hung from a loop at the back of the saddle.
"Do you suppose that you could reconsider just a bit, friend?"
the little Drasnian called plaintively to the ferryman.
"One gold piece,"
the ferryman repeated stubbornly. Silk sighed.
"Do you mind if we look at your boat? It doesn't look all that safe to me."
"Help yourself, but I won't move it until I get paid."
Silk looked at Durnick.
"Bring the axe," he said.
Durnick dismounted and lifted his broad-bladed axe from its loop. Then the two of them climbed down the slippery bank to the barge. They went up the sloping ramp and onto the deck. Silk stamped his feet tentatively on the planking.
Nice boat, he said to the ferryman, who stood cautiously some distance away. Are you sure you want to reconsider the price?
1 gold piece, take it or leave it.
Silk sighed. Oh, I was afraid you might take that position. He scuffed 1 foot at the muddy deck. You know more about boats than I do, friend, he observed. How long do you think that it would take this tub to sink if my friend here chopped a hole in the bottom?
The ferryman gaped at him.
Pull up the decking in the bow, Durnick, Silk suggested pleasantly. Give yourself plenty of room for a good swing.
The desperate ferryman grabbed up a club and ran down the bank.
Careful, friend, Silk said to him. We left Marizeth only yesterday, and I am already starting to feel a little feverish. Something I ate, no doubt.
The ferryman froze in his tracks. Durnick was grinning as he began to pry up the decking at the front of the barge.
My friend here is an expert woodsman, Silk continued in a conversational tone. And his axe is terribly sharp. I'll wager he can have this scow lying on the bottom inside of 10 minutes.
I can see into the hold now, Durnick reported, suggestively testing the edge of his axe with his thumb. Just how big a hole would you like?
Oh, I don't know, Durnick. A yard or so square, maybe. Would that sink it?
I'm not sure. Why don't we try it and find out?
Durnick pushed up the sleeves of his short jacket and hefted his axe a couple of times. The ferryman was making strangled noises now and hopping up and down.
What's your feeling about negotiation at this point, friend? Silk asked him.
I'm almost positive we can reach an accommodation, now that you fully understand the situation. When they were partway across the river, and the barge was wallowing heavily in the current, Durnick walked forward to the bow and stood looking into the opening he had made by prying up the deck.
I wonder how big a hole it would take to sink this thing, he mused.
What was that, dear? Polgara asked him.
Oh, just thinking out loud, Paul. But do you know something? I just realized that I've never sunk a boat before.
She rolled her eyes heavenward.
Oh, Min, she sighed.
I suppose I'd better put the planks back, so that we can lead the horses off on the other side, Durnick said almost regretfully.
They erected their tents in the shelter of a grove of cedar trees near the river that evening. The sky, which had been serene and blue since they had arrived in Meloria, had turned threatening as the sun sank, and there were rumbles of thunder and brief flickers of lightning among the clouds off to the west. After supper, Durnick and Toth went out of the grove for a look around and returned with sober faces.
I'm afraid that we're in for a spell of bad weather, the smith reported. You can smell it coming.
Oh, I hate riding in the rain, Silk complained.
Most people do, Prince Keldar, Feldegast told him. Aye, most people do, Prince Keldar, Feldegast told him. But bad weather usually keeps others in as well, don't you know? And if what that hungry traveller told us this afternoon be true, we'll not be wanting to meet the sort of folk that be abroad in Vena when the weather's fine.
He mentioned the Candom, Zadi said, frowning. Just exactly who are they?
The Candom are an order within the Grodom Church, Belgaroth told him. When Torek built Tolmishrek, he converted certain Grolums into hounds to patrol the region. After Vomimbre, when Torek was bound in sleep, Irvan converted about half of them back. The ones who reassumed human form are all sorcerers of greater or lesser talent, and they can communicate with the ones who are still hounds. They are very close-knit, like a pack of wild dogs, and they are all fanatically loyal to Irvan.
And that be much of the source of Irvan's power, Feldegast added. Ordinary Grolums be always scheming against each other and against their superiors. But Irvan's Candom
have kept the Malorian Grolems in line for 500 years now.
And the Temple Guardsmen? Zadi added.
Are they Gundam? Are Grolems too?
Not usually, Belgarath replied. There are Grolems among them, of course. But most of them are Malorian Angoraks. They were recruited before Vomimbre to serve as Torak's personal bodyguard.
Why would a god need a bodyguard?
I have never entirely understood that myself, the old man admitted. Anyway, after Vomimbre, there are still a few of them left, new recruits, veterans who'd been wounded in earlier battles and sent home, that sort of thing. Ervan persuaded them that he spoke for Torak, and now their allegiance is to him. After that, they recruited more young Angoraks to fill up the holes in their ranks. They do more than just guard the temple now. When Ervan started having difficulties with the emperors at Melzeth, he decided that he needed a fighting force, and so he expanded them into an army.
"'Tis a practical arrangement," Feldegast pointed out. "The Gundam provide Ervan with the sorcery he needs to keep the other Grolem's toe in the mark, and the Temple Guardsmen provide the muscle to keep the ordinary folk from protesting their lot."
"All these guardsmen, then, they're just ordinary soldiers?"
"Not really. They are closer to being knights," Belgarath replied.
"Like Mandaralan, you mean? All dressed in steel plate and with shields and lances, war horses, all of that?"
"No, goodman," Feldegast answered. "They're not nearly so grand. Lances and helmets and shields they have, certainly. But for the rest, they rely on chainmail. They be most nearly as stupid as errands, however. Something about wearing all that steel empties the mind of every knight the world round."
Belgarath was looking speculatively at Geryon.
"How muscular are you feeling?" he asked.
"Not very. Why?"
"We have got a bit of a problem here. We are far more likely to encounter guardsmen than we are Kandam. But if we start unhorsing all these 10 men with our minds, the noise is going to attract the Kandam like a beacon."
Geryon stared at him.
"Oh, you're not serious. I'm not Mandaralan, Grandfather."
"No, you have got better sense than he has."
"I will not stand by and hear my knight insulted,"
Synedra declared hotly.
"Synedra," Belgarath said almost absently. "Hush."
"Hush?"
"You heard me."
He scowled at her so blackly that she faltered and drew back behind Polgara for protection.
"The point, Geryon," the old man continued, "is that you have received a certain amount of training from Mandaralan in this sort of thing, and you have had a bit of experience. None of the rest of us have."
"I don't have any armor."
"You have got a mail shirt."
"I don't have a helmet, or a shield."
"I could probably manage those, Geryon," Durnik offered.
Geryon looked at his old friend.
"I'm terribly disappointed in you, Durnik," he said.
"You aren't afraid, are you, Geryon?"
Synedra asked in a small voice.
"Well, no, not really. It's just that it's so stupid, and it looks so ridiculous."
"Have you got an old pot I could borrow, Paul?" Durnik asked.
"How big of a pot?"
"Big enough to fit Geryon's head."
"Oh, now that's going too far," Geryon exclaimed. "I'm not going to wear a kitchen pot on my head for a helmet. I haven't done that since I was a boy."
"Oh, I'll modify it a bit," Durnik assured him. "And then I'll take the lid and make you a shield."
Geryon walked away, swearing to himself. Velvet's eyes had narrowed. She looked at Feldegast with no hint of her dimples showing.
"Tell me, Master Juggler," she said. "How is it that an itinerant entertainer, who plays for pennies in wayside taverns, knows so very much about the inner working of Grolem society here in Meloria?"
"I be not nearly so foolish as I look, milady," he replied.
and I do have eyes and ears, and know how to use 'em.